You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, March 24th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, William Newman, author of Things Are Never So Bad That They Can't Get Worse Inside the Collapse of Venezuela, and Summer Lee, congressional candidate in Pennsylvania's 12th District. Meanwhile, the political theater of questioning Ketanji Brown Jackson in her confirmation hearings is over, thank the non-existent Lord. Today, legal interest groups will testify on her behalf. And on Monday, the Senate will vote, so expect her to get confirmed. And here's why those confirmations are important. Yesterday, the Supreme Court threw out Wisconsin's redistricting plans, which were approved by a Republican state Supreme Court judge, which is a huge, and now it's a huge blow to the Voting Rights Act in the state. Biden is meeting with the rest of NATO to discuss Russia's invasion of Ukraine. They're set to talk about an increased presence along the eastern flank, as Russia says they'll consider using nuclear weapons if there is a, quote, existential threat. Great. It has now officially been 1 month since the invasion began. A New York prosecutor who resigned shortly after the new DA, Alvin Bragg, took over, has released a statement, an open letter, explaining his outrage over Bragg not pursuing a Trump indictment. Trump is, quote, guilty of numerous felony violations, the prosecutor says.
What's that? Felony, you say?
Talk to my lawyers. I don't got time for this.
The Biden administration is likely to recommend a second booster for those 65 and older as new COVID cases begin to creep up again. And Moderna will seek authorization for its COVID vaccine shots for babies, toddlers, and young children. Lastly, as predicted, Idaho's Republican governor has signed its near-total abortion ban modeled after Texas's law. That means abortions after 6 weeks are banned in the state. Governor Little called it unwise, but he signed it anyway. He is facing a far-right primary challenge, so female sacrifices are needed. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. We have a great show for you today. I might have some disagreements with our author on Venezuela, which makes it an interesting conversation, but I'm excited to get into it. And I'm really excited to have Summer Lee on, for sure. I want to keep highlighting some congressional candidates. And Summer Lee has been endorsed by Sunrise Movement, Justice Democrats, Bernie Sanders himself. She was a Bernie Sanders organizer. And is currently in the Pennsylvania State House. So she has firsthand experiences with that crazy Republican legislature there. And I'm excited to get into that with her after we speak to William Newman. But first, as the Supreme Court hearings for Ketanji Brown Jackson come to a close in terms of her testimony, interest groups are going to be testifying on her behalf today and being questioned as well by the Senate, but the vote is set to happen on Monday. We are yet again reminded of the importance of the Supreme Court. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled on a Wisconsin redistricting case, and I wanted to highlight this at the top of the show. They essentially threw out Wisconsin's new legislative districts and claim that it was a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. Everyone check out Mark Joseph Stern. We've had him on this program multiple times. He's the number one person, in my opinion, who's covering the Supreme Court at Slate. I'm going to be reading from his piece on this today. Wednesday's unsigned decision issued through a shadow docket hands Wisconsin Republicans an unexpected victory in their quest to reduce black representation in the legislature. It also alters the law of redistricting in fundamental yet cryptic ways that might, to a cynic, seem designed to disadvantage Democrats in every single case. I am said cynic, and that is the case. So what's insane about this ruling in particular is that a Republican Supreme Court justice essentially greenlit this redistricting plan. Wisconsin Republicans sued or appealed or whatever and brought it to the Supreme Court, and it was considered a Hail Mary and something that probably would not work out in their favor. But this Supreme Court is so far right that it sided with them anyway. So as Stern describes it, it's an astonishing, inexplicable decision here. Wisconsin Legislature versus Wisconsin Elections Commission is an unusual case. It arose because the state's Democratic governor and GOP-controlled legislature could not agree on new maps following the 2020 census. The Wisconsin Supreme Court stepped in to referee the dispute, allowing parties to submit draft maps for its consideration, including Governor Tony Evers and legislative leaders. A majority declared it would abide by a least change rule, selecting the maps that made the fewest changes to the current plan. Applying this standard, the court adopted Evers' map in March. Notably, Justice Brian Hagerton, a conservative Republican, authored the majority opinion. His decision largely preserved the current Republican gerrymander, but it also increased the number of majority black assembly districts in Milwaukee from 6 to 7. Now, Milwaukee's black population has increased. Evers and the decision makers in this instance basically said that's why there needs to be an additional seat. And the Republican Supreme Court in Wisconsin, or at least the Republican who issued the majority opinion for the Supreme Court, agreed. It was not by any means some sort of radical redistricting. It was one designed to do the least redistricting, tweaking it a bit, while also attempting to represent the new black residents in Milwaukee. Evers believed that due to the growth of Milwaukee's black population over the decade, the current map diluted minority votes in violation of the Voting Rights Act. Black residents were now packed into too few districts. Republicans appealed Hagerton's decision. That was Evers' reasoning. But let's skip to when they appealed to the Supreme Court, arguing that it constituted an illegal 21st century racial gerrymander. On Wednesday, SCOTUS agreed. The majority admitted that it wasn't sure whether to fault Evers or Hagerton, which is for adopting the 7th district, so it blamed both of them. First, it claimed that Evers put forth insufficient evidence demonstrating that without a 7th majority black district, the plan would violate the Voting Rights Act. Second, it faulted Hagerton for failing to consider whether a race-neutral alternative that did not add a 7th majority black district would deny black voters equal political opportunity. Sonia Sotomayor dissented along with Elena Kagan. We don't have a record of the votes based on like this new shadow docket strategy that the Supreme Court, it's not new, but they're seemingly adopting it more and more. But Stern goes into the analysis of why the decision is ridiculous. But the number one reason here is the decision rewarded the Republicans for making this case. Here Stern writes, in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, Republicans argued that the VRA required multiple majority black districts in Milwaukee. They then ambushed the courts with last-minute complaints about an alleged racial gerrymander. SCOTUS rewarded their behavior, accusing Hagerton of failing to undertake an analysis that no party asked him to undertake. Because he was basically going forward with the standard of, let's tweak the maps, let's try to incorporate new black voters in Milwaukee. He wasn't looking at it through a Voting Rights Act analysis. And then the Supreme Court essentially accuses him of not using that analysis. And here's the real key point that I wanted to get to. In the Alabama redistricting case that the Supreme Court recently undertook, they talked about how in Alabama, the decision to basically allow for them to gerrymander racially was due to the fact that it was too close to an election. They did not use that analysis here. There's a third problem with the decision that Sotomayor does not mention. It flagrantly violates the Purcell rule. This rule holds that federal courts should not alter state election laws shortly before an election. The conservative justices have invoked it relentlessly to freeze lower court decisions expanding voting rights. In February, they deployed it to block a decision requiring Alabama to undergo its egregious racial gerrymander because the primaries were 3.5 months away. Now, the conservatives have pushed aside Purcell to overturn Wisconsin's legislative map when the primaries are 4.5 months away. So there you have it. They're contradicting themselves state by state in order to ensure Republican hegemony. And that's the reality here.
Yeah, it's a loaded dice against your voting rights.
Yep. Wanted to highlight that. And in the meantime, we'll just like, let's look at this quickly. Because Cory Booker, this is going to be a Cory Booker heavy show today. We have a clip of him talking about crypto that we'll play later in the program. But these hearings were so insane and filled with not so subtle racial dog whistles directed at Ketanji Brown Jackson. She had to sit through assaults on her character. This happens often with Supreme Court nominees. More egregious because of her race and her gender.
Yeah. If you wanted to look at like what the inquisitors of the Salem witch trials look like when they were interrogating people, back in Salem, this is the modern equivalent of it.
Yes. And so Cory Booker felt the need to bring it back and put the historic nature of her nomination into context after the Republicans were so adversarial and ridiculous. Now, Cory Booker, I just wish he wasn't so Cory Booker here. Like, he's so corny. Yeah. But at the same time, her tears and her reaction are moving, and I think something that we should be highlighting.
Yeah, Cory knows his audience for some of this stuff.
Right.
I went to law school. I didn't serve on the law review. You did. I didn't clerk at every level of the federal court. You clerked for a Supreme Court justice, one widely respected on both sides, which really shaped you. And you did not get there because of some left-wing agenda? You didn't get here because of some dark money groups? You got here how every black woman in America who's gotten anywhere has done by being, like Ginger Rogers said, I did everything Fred Astaire did, but backwards in heels. And I want to tell you, when I look at you, this is why I get emotional. I'm sorry, you're a person that is so much more than your race and gender. You're a Christian, you're a mom, you're an intellect, you love books. But for me, I'm sorry, I it's hard for me not to look at you and not see my mom, not to see my cousins, one of them who had to come here and sit behind you. She had to have your back. I see my ancestors and yours. Nobody's going to steal the joy of that woman in the street or the calls that I'm getting or the texts. Nobody's going to steal that joy. You have earned this spot. You are worthy. You are a great American.
That's it?
Yeah.
Okay. Look, again, I feel like I'm constantly beating back my own cynicism when I know that that's not the main point. It's just like, I hate the grandstanding. I hate it.
Although, I mean, that's what this is an opportunity for,
yes.
Really.
and it seems like it gets worse every year, every Supreme Court nominee, because people recognize and senators recognize this is a good opportunity for them and to raise their profile, maybe raise some money as well. But he is right that this is historic, and it's been lost in the Ted Cruz attacks on her about you know, do you know what a woman is? Am I an Asian man? Like the ridiculous ways that they're trying to appeal to their base. Underneath all of that is the fact that we're about to very, very likely have a black woman for the first time on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and what she's been put through by the GOP has been heinous and disgusting.
Yes, and frankly, it's not even somebody whose record I have a ton of quibbles with. I mean, look, judges, you're not going to be a DSA activist and be a judge, but she's done a lot of really good work within the confines of her profession as compared to someone else that, you know, Biden was considering, like Childs, for example. So you, I think, can feel really good on one, the historic nature of her nomination, and also the quality of the jurist and her background as a public defender, among many other things. So within the confines of who Biden was going to nominate, I'm very happy with her. I think she also conducted herself incredibly well. And let's just also not let the broader historicism and milestone get lost in all of this ridiculous politicking by the senators here.
Yeah.
So again, Corey, I wish she were a little less cringe, but the sentiment is it.
Exactly. I think, like, you know, Corey can go for it in this moment. I also agree with what Jeremy Flood said. Theater kids need to be stopped, in my opinion.
That is the energy, right? That is the energy. Corey was really monologuing. Mr. Johnson is going to be pleased. You're going to get the best part in Chicago. All right, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be joined by William Newman.
We'll be right back.
We are back, and we are joined by William Newman, author of Things Are Never So Bad That They Can't Get Worse, Inside the Collapse of Venezuela. William, thank you so much for being here today. Really appreciate it.
Hi, Emma. Thanks for having me.
So, yeah, of course. So you lived in Venezuela for a few years, and you lived really, you know, during the collapse in the mid, you know, 2010. So let's just start there about your experience living in Venezuela and how that informed the subject of your book.
Sure. Well, I was very fortunate in when I got down there, because I went down there. I was at the New York Times, and so I went down there as the Andes region correspondent. And I lived in Caracas for 4 years, and I got there in 2012. And 2012 was a boom year in Venezuela. So I got to see the country when it was booming and full of money. And that year, Chavez, the previous year, had come down with cancer. And then he declared himself cancer-free because in 2012, he was running for re-election. So I got to be there and cover the last election campaign of Chavez. I got to see the country when oil was over $100 a barrel. And then, of course, the next year after Chavez is reelected, he dies from cancer in early 2013. And he has already designated Maduro as his successor. And so Maduro wins the replacement election. And there's basically, so then I got to see the beginning of the whole Maduro thing. And there's basically two crises that happen in Venezuela, one after the other. First, there's the political crisis where Chavez dies. And Chavez was the great caudillo and the sort of center of all political gravity in the country. And so he dies, and that initiates this political crisis. And then a year later, the price of oil falls, and that begins the economic crisis. And so Maduro becomes president, and he's very uncertain politically, very unstable. And he has to both fend off an energized opposition after Chavez's death and all sorts of factions within Chavismo who don't necessarily trust him or want him there. And then the price of oil drops, and ultimately by the beginning of 2015, it gets down to, I think, close to $30 a barrel. And that
from
means
what? From $100 a barrel.
It's been over 100, yeah. It's been up to almost 120. And so essentially what happens in Venezuela is they ran out of money, because oil is the really almost the only game economically in Venezuela. They have the biggest oil reserves in the world. And they had, during the boom years of the early, of the mid, of the 2000s, when oil prices went through the roof, they never saved any money. So there was nothing in the bank when the price of oil dropped. And so they essentially run out of money, and that begins this sort of horrible economic crisis, which, you know, has resulted in 8 consecutive years of economic contraction. They lost 80% of their GDP. I mean, it's the kind of, depression, economic depression that's almost inconceivable. Hyperinflation, all sorts of problems, this huge refugee outflow. And so I was there for the beginning of all that. I come back to New York, but then I continued to return to Venezuela to report over the years. And I especially spent a lot of time there in 2019 writing the book, which was the year of these massive nationwide power blackouts and the whole the start of Maduro's second term, and then Juan Guaido declares himself president, and the U.S. is coming down on them with sanctions, and Trump is threatening to invade. And so I saw all that firsthand as well. And then I was just back a couple months ago and writing some more. So.
Wow. All right. Well, Trump threatening to invade. I almost like put that in my black box of my memory hole, right? I just don't even want to imagine and think about that anymore.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing there is that, you know, it was all bluster because Trump comes out and he says, oh, you know, we're considering all our options, including military options, you know, which means I want to invade. And I think he even said, you know, Bolton, I think in his memoir, says that Trump says it would be cool to invade. But the fact is that the Defense Department never, they refused to do any planning for any kind of military action in Venezuela. They just ignored it all.
Well, Good.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Right. I mean, the important thing to understand about all that, and, you know, especially when we're talking about sanctions as well, is that Trump never had a Venezuela foreign policy. He only had a Florida election strategy that utilized Venezuela. So everything he did wasn't to, in the hopes of reaching some sort of suitable beneficial outcome for Venezuela. It was about being able to use Venezuela as an edge in Florida elections. And it was very successful because in the midterms, when Trump was president, they win the governorship and another Senate seat. And then in 2020, Trump wins Florida and the Democrats lose a couple of congressional seats. And what happens now is that Biden inherits this, you know, mess, and his hands are tied, because if he tries to change what Trump did, it's going to have electoral repercussions in Florida again. And I think the Democrats are terrified of that.
Yeah. And in terms of using Venezuela for his election strategy, a lot of that pins on the fact that socialism as a concept has like a brand cachet that can be used for domestic purposes by right-wing organizations here in the U.S., but in terms of how it was used in Venezuela as well for their domestic politics, right. That's something that's really interesting I want to get into as well. But, you mentioned U.S. sanctions there and how the effect of U.S. sanctions. I'm particularly interested in that as a podcast based in the United States. How did that have an effect on the fact that there is, as you say, no money in Venezuela, exacerbating the economic collapse that happened in the mid 2010s?
Well, it comes in stages because the way that the economic crisis begins in Venezuela is actually when Chavez is running for re-election in 2012. And they're borrowing billions of dollars. They're spending as much money as they can to juice the economy up so that they can get this sort of sick and dying Chavez across the finish line and win the election, which they do. But by now, the economy's in trouble because there's all these, you know, there's tremendous, you know, all this deficit spending. The economy's too hot. And then Maduro comes in and he doesn't know how to handle it. And he sort of, you know, continues with a bunch of policies that need to be changed, but he's too uncertain to make any changes. And then the price of oil drops and they run out of money. Not good. And then Trump comes into office and Trump starts hitting Venezuela with these, you know, with these general sanctions. There's two kinds of sanctions. There's individual ones against, you know, bad guys or perceived bad guys. And then there's general sanctions that hit the whole economy. And the first one basically shuts Venezuela pretty much off from the U.S. financial system, which means they're being shut off from the world financial system because so much of it goes through the U.S. And that exacerbates the problem. So you have this already existing economic crisis, and it's going to get worse now because they're piling on these sanctions that make things more difficult economically for Venezuela. And then ultimately, in 2019, you have this phenomenon where Juan Guaido, this young legislator, declares himself president. The U.S. backs him and recognizes right. him as a legitimate president of Venezuela. All these other countries do as well. And John Bolton is sitting there in the White House, NSC, and he says, let's go for the win. That's his quote that he reports. And so he pushes through the oil sanction, which is essentially an oil embargo. The U.S. used to be the main buyer of Venezuelan oil. And it basically bans Venezuelan oil sales to the U.S. And that's sort of like the ultimate sanction. And it's interesting now because this is all in the news because there's this debate about whether or not to lift the oil sanctions. Biden sent this group of envoys to talk to Maduro in Caracas. And one of the things they talked about was once again the U.S. buying Venezuelan oil. And that immediately gets this fierce backlash from politicians, especially in Florida, where it's an election issue, against ever, you know, doing anything to soften the U.S. stance toward Maduro. And it's interesting because you have to ask, well, why do we have the oil sanction? And we don't have it because somebody sat down and said, well, you know, this is, you know, we've scoped out all the possibilities and this is the best way to go forward. We have it because John Bolton said, let's go for the win. And yeah. he slammed the biggest sanction, sort of the biggest baseball bat they had to whack them over the head. But I've talked to people and it's in the book. What I discovered is that there was a fierce debate about whether or not to use the oil sanction. And before Bolton, you had McMaster at the NSC. And his people charted out this very careful sort of escalating use of sanctions, both in the individual and general. And at the very end, they put the oil sanction. And in talking to them, these people told me that they never envisioned using it because it could be so devastating to the Venezuelan economy and essentially to ordinary Venezuelans. And the way it was described to me, it was like one person called it the nuclear bomb of sanctions. Mm-hmm. Another person called it, they described it as like a break glass in case of emergency thing. In other words, if their goal was to get rid of Maduro, if they saw that he just needed like one more push to go, then you use that sanction, and this is how they see it. And then he's gone, and then you lift the sanction. But the way this person described it, he says, if that doesn't happen, then you're stuck with it, and you have another Cuba. And essentially, Venezuela has become the new Cuba, because now you have this sort of total embargo on Venezuela with no benefits from it. No benefits to the Venezuelan people. You're not achieving your stated goal of getting rid of Maduro. And the only benefit is to Republican politicians in Florida.
Right. And it echoes some of what was happening in the lead up to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, where there were a lot of Republican politicians pushing for preemptive sanctions. I mean, I'm on the left. I find that to be a ridiculous concept. But like you saying that Venezuela's turned into the new Cuba is really fascinating to me, because it's essentially like a political anti-commie football for Republican politicians. And once you begin those sanctions, as you say, and you begin that kind of punitive treatment, it's really hard for like a centrist Democrat like Biden, or he perceives it this way, to walk that back because of the political ramifications. I guess talk a little bit, I want to get more into Venezuela domestically, but could you talk a little bit more about that dynamic?
About the dynamic where Biden is stuck with these policies?
Yeah.
I mean, essentially, you have this sort of ultimate sanction on Venezuela, and its existence is now its justification. In other words, right. Because it's there, we can't lift it. Oh, well, why do we have it in the first place? We have it because somebody who didn't think about the consequences, you know, wanted to go all out and, you know, try and get rid of Maduro, and it didn't work. But now we're stuck with it. You know, the Democrats were just spanked in Florida in 2020. Trump wins the state. They lose two congressional seats. And the Republicans, this wasn't the only reason. The Republicans out-organized the Democrats in Florida. But yes. They also conducted this, you know, campaign bombarding especially Hispanic voters with this message. Biden's a socialist, he's Maduro's friend, he's going to turn the U.S. into Venezuela. And there's not a lot of Venezuelan-American voters, but in Florida there's a lot of Cuban-Americans, Colombian-Americans, Nicaraguan-Americans, and they all respond to this same message. And so, you know, and now you see that happening now where there's talk about do we buy Venezuelan oil again, and Marco Rubio and others come out against it, and then Val Demings comes out against it because she's running against Marco Rubio, et cetera, Menendez in New Jersey. So you're stuck, and you really don't have a lot of options. And basically Biden, I think, has just kept hands off with Venezuela mostly because they don't see any way that they can win there. They can only get burned. And so, and he's got a million other problems, obviously. So there hasn't been much attention to Venezuela. So,
yeah, and I mean, I except that they, when you are static and your predecessor is a far right winger, you are just essentially maintaining those policies, including the recognition of Guaido as the leader, which Biden was at a democracy summit talking about how that is the reality. When, like, you know, Maduro has a ton of problems, but Guaido is not the leader of Venezuela. Well, I mean, can you talk about that policy?
No, absolutely. Sure. No, absolutely. Yeah. You know, at this moment, inside Venezuela, almost nobody talks about Guaido. Inside Venezuela, Guaido is essentially irrelevant. Outside Venezuela is where he has relevance, and that means essentially in Washington and Miami. So, you know, the U.S. and a few other countries continue to recognize him as president. But the way I describe Guaido in the book is that Guaido was essentially a bubble that lasted about 4 months. In January of 2019, he declares himself president. It's done in coordination with the White House and the State Department, and probably the Colombians as well. And I don't mean that it was some sort of U.S. Maneuver or operation. It was something that, you know, came out of Venezuela. They told the State Department, and State Department got on board, essentially. But it was done in coordination with the U.S., but not in coordination with the other elements of the opposition in Venezuela. Guaido belongs to a small party that essentially, on its own, decided to, take this chance, this risky gambit and see what happened. And so he gets a tremendous sort of boost at the beginning because the U.S. and all these, 50 other countries recognize him as a legitimate president. And the fact is that Maduro engineered his reelection the year before in 2018 by banning the other popular politicians who could run against him, banning them from running. He monkeyed with the election rules. He moved up the date of the election. And he essentially, the opposition sort of fell for it, decided to boycott the election, and Maduro's reelected. But it wasn't, you can't consider that a legitimate election because of the manipulation of the other candidates and the election rules.
Both things can be true, right? Like Guaido cannot be the president and the election. Two thoughts in your mind at the same time.
Right. The opposition could have come because Maduro's term starts in January, and the opposition is trying to figure out how to deal with this new term of this guy who's not legitimately elected. And they could have gone to the populace and said, look, we've got this unusual situation here. We're going to act as a opposition against it. But they choose this clause in the Constitution, which they claim, requires Guaido, who at the time was the head of the National Assembly, to step in as president. But it was a political decision. Anyway, so he declares himself president. There's this huge outflowing of support in the country. Tons of demonstrations because people are fed up. I mean, the country's been, in an economic hole for years at that point, and there was repression and all these refugees going out. It was a terrible crisis, still is. And so there's a lot of popular support for Guaido. But then nothing happens because there was never a plan. There wasn't a strategy where, like, we're going to declare ourselves president, then we'll do this and this. It was just sort of magical thinking where they hoped that the military would rise up and get rid of Maduro or the gringos would invade. And none of that ever happened. And so Guaido sort of putters along for a few months. There were a few sort of big, I don't know if you remember, they were going to bring in all this aid into the country, and the U.S. flies these huge military planes into Colombia and unload all this aid, and they can't bring it in. And then he stages this very strange sort of coup that's not really a coup, where he's standing outside on this overpass. I don't know if you remember all that.
Yes,
but anyway,
I do.
A lot of sort of mistakes that were made. And that goes on for a few months. And then everybody just walks away because Guaido comes in promising, instant gratification, promising immediate results. We're going to get rid of Maduro. And he can't. And he doesn't because he's not really president. He doesn't really have a government. And there was never a plan or a real strategy to get it done. And so then, after 4 months, basically the air goes out of Guaido. And then a few, like 6 months later, you have that strange mini invasion by that guy, Goudreau, who sends these people on these two boats. One group of people on a boat is killed. The other boat has these two American Green Berets who are taken prisoner and are still there in prison. And that was sort of like the last hurrah. He's still there. He still, calls himself the president of Venezuela. But people in Venezuela have moved on, including, the other the political parties. And they want to take a more realistic course to try and act as a responsible opposition.
Right.
And yet, it's all frozen in Washington. Washington doesn't recognize any of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's just that Right, exactly. And I've been frustrated in many, I think a lot of what the Biden administration's done in response to this Russian invasion has been good. Some of it I haven't agreed with, but stuff in terms of not reversing Trump's radical foreign policy and just kind of maintaining it in terms like Title 42 at the border. That's not foreign policy, but his posture towards Venezuela. I mean, the Biden administration has taken a really passive approach to that that I think is not going to work out for them in the long run. But I don't want to get too bogged down in domestic politics here. I want to turn a little bit more specifically to Venezuela. And to the right in this country, or to the right, see, I'm back, but to the right, everything that I don't like is socialism, right? Venezuela is this socialist hellscape is how it's presented, when in reality, that's not exactly the case in terms of how the Venezuelan economy is organized. Can you talk a little bit more about that distinction and why it's important to understanding socialist politics Sure. internationally and in Venezuela as well?
Well, I mean, my take, and it's not a very common one, is that Venezuela isn't and never has been a socialist country. Socialism Chavez wasn't a socialist, he was a populist. And Chavez was one of the first people in this new wave of autocrats that we see around the world who come to power through democratic means. And then once they're in power, they dismantle the democratic system to stay in power. And they take away the checks and balances and, you know, other things that we've seen in many countries. I mean, it's interesting because Chavez first takes office in 1999, and the other political figure who's on the scene now who takes office in 99 is Vladimir Putin. But Chavez didn't invent a lot of these things, but he showed that they still worked. Chavez, populism in this sense is you have this charismatic leader who has this direct connection with the people. They call them the people. But the people isn't everybody. It's just the supporters of the leader. And it's important to sort of mine the increasing polarization of society and the electorate in order to have enemies and stay in power. There's the people, and then everybody else is the enemy who's in league with foreign enemies. It's a thing that we've seen repeated all over now in Hungary and Poland and in Brazil and in Russia as well. And now with Maduro especially, it includes taking over of media outlets, eliminating opposition media, that sort of thing. And also, you know, with Maduro increasing repression. But getting back to socialism, so Chavez comes in and, you know, socialism in Venezuela for Chavez is really a form of branding. It's a form of marketing. It's a way to sell the personality and the cause of the president. And it's a, you know, it's a very popular, sexy thing. And he, and there's a long tradition in Latin America, that he sort of taps into. But there was never any real attempt in Venezuela. Venezuela has always been a market-oriented capitalist country. One of the interesting things about Venezuela that makes it different from other countries is that oil is such a big part of the economy, and the government has controlled the oil industry for decades. So the government has always had this very central role in the economy, much more than in other countries. So even before Chavez, you had that, and Venezuela was second only to Cuba in terms of government control of the economy. And Chavez comes in, and he sort of reverts to what was popular in Latin America in the 60s and 70s, when there were a lot of government takeovers of certain industries or important companies, or the government would create companies or build steel mills and stuff. And then that was the trend in the 60s and 70s. In the 80s and 90s, it was reversed, and all these governments sold all these things. And Chavez comes in and he buys them back, or he starts new ones. But that's not socialism. That's just, you know, state participation in the economy.
So then what do you how do you categorize the redistribution of that oil wealth downward? I mean, there was that was what was done by Chavez that was successful in a way.
Well, I wouldn't call it successful. What I would say is that governments in Venezuela had always taken the oil money and used it, you know, for social programs and other things. What happens is that you get the oil boom in the 70s, but then by the 80s, you've got the bust. And so Venezuela goes through the 80s and 90s in this horrible period of economic stagnation. And so the governments had no money to spend on social programs. Chavez comes in and he's very lucky because the price of oil goes up. You know, he's got all this money to spend. And yes, he does create what he calls the missions, which are social programs of all sorts, educational programs, clinics, building hospitals and bridges and infrastructure. The problem is that it was so badly done. In other words, it's great to come in and say, well, I'm going to teach people to, I'm going to start a medical school. But when the students come out of the medical school and they can't work as doctors because the school is so badly operated that they didn't learn, that doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help to say, well, we're going to, one of the things they did that was successful for a while is that they created this whole system of clinics. It was called Barrio Dentro, these small clinics throughout the country, especially in poor areas, that were staffed by Cuban doctors. And that worked, and it was popular, but it there was no follow through. So over time, the whole thing was essentially abandoned. I mean, I was all over the country. Sometimes I would find these clinics working, and often I would find them just empty and sitting there. So there was no the management of these programs was terrible, and there was a tremendous amount of waste and corruption involved in all of these things. What the Chavistas like to do is they say that the period before Chavez was all this sort of like hellscape where everything was bad and corrupt and nothing worked and the poor got nothing. And then the opposition likes to say that the period before Chavez was this golden era. And neither one is true. Chavez doesn't come out of nowhere. Chavez is born from what came before. And a lot of what he did mimics what was done before. He just had more money to do it with. And, unfortunately, he had more money to waste as well, and there was more money to steal. So he does these things, but he does them badly. And I don't think that that's socialism. I don't think that when you look at the poor in Venezuela today, they're more poor, more extreme poor, and they're worse off than before.
Well, and that you can trace that to the reliance, I guess, on oil as the end all be all, really. I mean, you can.
I'm careful because there's ways to manage the oil income.
Right.
Chavez saved nothing during all those years. I mean, for instance, I also covered Bolivia, and Bolivia was very different because Bolivia also had a boom because Bolivia has a lot of natural gas. And they had a boom in selling natural gas to Argentina and Brazil. And Bolivia saved huge amounts of money so that when the price fell, they had a big cushion to work with. The Chavistas saved nothing. There was zero saved in Venezuela there was no rainy day fund. There was no planning for that. A lot of countries in the 70s, in that first oil boom, these oil countries went through the same sort of process. They went through this boom and then this terrible bust, and they, had a hard time recovering from that. A lot of those countries learned from that experience. Venezuela did not, and they made the same mistakes again.
So, but if it's poor in its execution, how is that not socialism then? In term, just because it's poor in its execution, or because you find the way that it was distributed not to be in keeping, it was not a centralized system, is what you're saying.
I mean, what is socialism? Is socialism a bunch of public benefit programs? Is it a command economy? Is it the road to communism? We could sit around and talk about all those things, but I think that in what I saw in Venezuela was that socialism was used as a rallying cry, but there was no execution. In other words, there was no serious attempt. It was a branding, which is, as you pointed out, it's also a branding in the United States in the opposite way. In other words, in Venezuela, it was like a sexy branding, socialism, whiter, brighter teeth. And in Florida, it's socialism, the boogeyman, right?
Yeah. I, fair enough. Yeah. I think that, that makes a lot of sense. And we touched on it a little bit at the start of our interview, but I just wanted to go through the history. You were living there as well during the time when oil crashed and what that looked like in the mid 2010s in Venezuela.
Well, what it looked like, it didn't look good. It was very ugly. Essentially, the country's income disappeared largely. What you had was, you had tremendous shortages of basic products. And what the government did, I mean, this gets complicated, but the government used price control. See, the government has subsidized products. One of them is gasoline. Gasoline was essentially free, but also a lot of basic foodstuffs. And so those would be sold really cheaply in the stores. And when the crisis started, people would buy up these cheap products in the stores and then sell them on the street for much higher prices. Or those products would be smuggled into Colombia where they could be sold at market prices. And so you had, you would get these extreme shortages of basic goods, and the stores would be empty, but on the street you could buy anything, but at a much elevated price. And so it got to the point where the government, you had assigned shopping days. So depending on the last number of your identification card, you could shop on certain days of the week. And the government had to send soldiers to patrol these. There would be immense lines outside of stores, people waiting to get inside. And they sent soldiers to check people's ID cards and stuff like that. And people would go in these stores and they would buy whatever was there. They didn't care what it was because, you know, it wasn't what they needed, but they could get it and they could sell it to somebody who did need it and then buy something else, whether it was corn flour or you know, something else they needed. So there were all these terrible dislocations that really, really hurt ordinary people as that was happening. And that was before the sanctions began.
Gotcha. Well, I literally just saw the time and realized that we're almost out of it. So I wanted to, it's a bit of a hard transition, but I definitely want to get to this with you. What is the state of the non-Maduro left in Venezuela? I mean, what are some, is there any leftist opposition alternatives that's growing in Venezuela because of, you know, something to combat the bloatedness and yes, the corruption that you talk about?
Well, the left was never just a right-wing left in Venezuela. I mean, Chavez and Maduro have always characterized it as that, like a bunch of right-wingers in league with the gringos and with the Colombians. And that was never the case. I mean, yes, there is a right and a hard right element to the Venezuelan left, opposition. But a lot of it was pretty centrist. And like people like Enrique Capriles, who ran against Chavez for president and Maduro, he's, you know, a centrist and in some ways might even be a left of center centrist. I think that especially at that point in Venezuela, there was a recognition that you were always going to have to maintain, you know, really important, significant social benefits and programs. Henry Falcón, who ran against Maduro in 2018, I think you could also put in that class. But more recently, as the country has just fallen apart and Maduro became more repressive, you have this dissident Chavismo. So you have a lot of people who have left Chavismo who are on the left, who either have gone, have broken off and criticized Maduro or have joined forces with the sort of more mainstream opposition. And especially lately, Maduro has started to throw some of those people in jail. And, you know, it's intriguing to wonder if he is hurting himself by creating a common cause from between the more mainstream left and this, you know, I'm sorry, the more mainstream opposition and the left opposition that has more recently split off. But they tend to be, it tends to be a fairly small group in terms of how vocal it is. But I would say that, I mean, the problem the opposition has, it has many problems, one of which is that it seems often more eager to fight among itself than to fight with the government. I was talking to Capriles when I was there last fall, and he said it's not enough to be against a dictatorship. You have to offer people something for them to give you their support. And so I think that the great sort of mass of Venezuelans is very disillusioned. They've lived through this horrible decade of, you know, disastrous economic policies and depression. And they're desperate for some kind of change. And I think that a lot of those people, you know, I don't know that it's possible to say ideologically where they stand. I think that what they need is somebody who can actually offer them more than just, let's get rid of this guy. Let's build something new here.
Well, I really appreciate your time today. William Newman, you can read his book, Things Are Never So Bad That They Can't Get Worse, Inside the Collapse of Venezuela. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Emma. Thanks very much.
All right, folks, we are going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will be joined by Summer Lee, candidate in Pennsylvania for Congress. Ooh. We are back, and we are joined now by Summer Lee, candidate for Congress in Pennsylvania's 12th District, parts of Pittsburgh in that area. Summer, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, Emma, thanks so much for having me.
I mean, I'm so happy to be talking to you and highlighting candidates like yourself. Congrats on the Sunrise Movement endorsement today.
Oh, yes, yes. So excited about that. We've been picking up a lot of steam. So we've had a good couple of weeks with some folks joining our coalition. So we're so excited and definitely just build out that movement here on the ground.
Yeah, Bernie endorsed you maybe a week ago or something, mm-hmm. and you are a Justice Democrat. So and definitely in good company with some of those endorsements for sure. Let's talk a little bit about your race. We've been talking about union busting lawyers in the context of the Supreme Court because Biden was considering nominating Childs, which he did not do. But you're actually facing off against one in your primary race. Talk a little bit about your opponent and what differentiates you from him.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair and to be honest, I actually have a couple of opponents.
Oh, so. Gotcha.
The thing that I'll say first about those guys, I don't know them that well, right? you know, I hear the things that other people hear, right? And their work product exists also, just like mine does. I just know that I've been a candidate and I was an organizer and just a person, like a community member who has been really strongly in favor of our workers, right? Standing with our workers on picket lines and in protests, right? Standing with them in boardrooms and really I think the center of everything that we do has to be for building power for poor and working class people. And as a poor and working class person, it informed everything that I've done. So I think that that's one thing that definitely sets me apart from my opponents, right? This is a lived experience. You know, when we talk about how important it is for our workers to be able to unionize, when we're talking about how important it is that they have rights on the job, right? Paid family, paid sick leave, healthcare. You know, these are things that impact me. They impact my family. They impact my community. They impact my community disproportionately. So that's what's really just driven my approach and our campaign's approach. And I think that it will show, you know, it shows in the coalition that we've built. It shows in the amount of unions and workers that have joined us. And I hope that my opponents will also stand with labor.
Yeah. Was that a priority for you in your race? Because I think that that's really a hallmark of how a lot of left-wing candidates are gaining traction and finding success is embracing labor. Was that something that you wanted to put at the forefront of your campaign?
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, it's the why, right? I think that when we're looking at just the systemic inequalities that we face in this country, you know, left candidates, progressive lefties, right? We're not just embracing labor because it's like an in vogue thing to do, or it's, you know, it's the thing that is good for branding. You know, I think that we truly understand to our core how integral like that labor piece is to our movement. I know that if we're fighting for Medicare for All or a Green New Deal, right, or housing justice, you know, a living wage, all of these things that we need right now, right, that we deserve and that we're fighting for, I know that the way that we win that will only come through a robust labor movement. It will only come through embracing our workers, centering our workers, right, expanding that electorate base, you know, through this poor and working class coalition. So I think I know that that's why I do, and I believe that that's why progressives are right in our framing of that, and we're right to really center that in all of our platform.
I agree. I mean, and I think that that's a part of an important piece of your campaign, but it's indicative of your policy objectives as well. Green New Deal, canceling student debt, Medicare for All, as you say. So all of the things that us on the left are really focused on as goals, policy wise. But, you know, I also want to talk a little bit about your experience in the Pennsylvania State House as well. Because the Pennsylvania legislature was in the news after the 2020 election, and it seems like you have some pretty aggressive Republicans mm-hmm. that are your colleagues. If you were to make it to Congress, you'd have to deal with the Republican Party on the national level as well. What has been your experience being in the Pennsylvania legislature, and how would you extrapolate that or use that if you were to win and represent Pennsylvania's 12th district in Congress?
Yeah, my word. I have had the distinct pleasure of being able, or I will say having to work with the Republicans for the last 4 years, 3 years and a half. It's absolutely been an experience. You know, I always, you mentioned, you know, after the election of 2020 and after, you know, the insurrection, Pennsylvania had more folks than any other place. And a number of them were my colleagues who were right there in insurrection, who were egging it on, right, who have been fundraising off of it. And their bills reflect that value, right? It reflects those values. Everything that they do reflects this radicalism, right? It reflects that white supremacy, that xenophobia. And I think that having dealt with it in Pennsylvania, I know that there is no place that we're going to get a more extreme version of this. Now, there are some legislatures that don't have that same safety net that we do in a Democratic governor.
Right.
But that, there is nothing that would be keeping us from being Florida, from being Texas and our laws. So I know, and I have more experience than any of these folks recognizing that nostalgia that we have for bipartisanship is a mischaracterization. I think it's a very unproductive framing of how we're going to win forward. The reality
is, you know what you're dealing with. I mean, like, just give us a sense of, I mean, the president is they fetishize bipartisanship and working together, but there is very, I feel like, little, they haven't updated their software for 40 years. That's what it's like, right? You get what the Republicans are like and what they're like on the state level, because that's just going to trickle upwards. So, I mean, just talk about, I mean, in the wake of the 2020 election, what did you see from your Republican colleagues in terms of their belief in, or lack of belief in democracy, and honestly, their fascist tendencies?
Yep. We've been auditing the election since then, right?
Yeah.
We're still auditing the election, still challenging the election results. So Pennsylvania led the charge. Our Pennsylvania legislature, with taxpayer dollars, right, led the charge to spread falsehoods that there was some sort of fraud during this election, that those results were not legitimate. There was that, right? Ever since COVID, right? As we've been fighting for paid family leave, we've been fighting for hazard pay, for PPE, for healthcare, for housing justice, right in the middle of a pandemic, right? They've been fighting for constitutional protections, that would say that we don't need vaccines at all, right? They've been fighting to make sure that the governor doesn't have any powers at all, because that has been the one kind of thing standing in their way from having absolute power in Pennsylvania.
Right.
That's what they've taught. That's what they've spent their time and their effort doing it. You know, I always mention, like, as a Black woman, right, not just as someone who comes from a working class background, you know, from a poor community, divested, and as a Black woman, you know, that bipartisanship or that civility that they're hearkening to, they're always talking about a time period when we weren't there. There weren't Black people there. There weren't women there, right? There weren't folks from refugee backgrounds there. So it was much easier for Democrats and Republicans to work together. They just put that one thing aside. I remember when we were celebrating a colleague or mourning a colleague, one of the other, like, but a colleague had come up, or an old colleague, someone who had worked there, and people were clapping and standing up, and three people walked up to me and was like, "Don't clap." That person was like almost certainly in the KKK.
Yeah.
Right. And those are the people who folks would ask us to just work better with, right? Just try harder, just reach across the aisle to be with them.
Yeah, it's just, that's this kind of obsession with our institutional processes. It's like a religious obsession. And the reality is that they were tools to uphold white supremacy. And they are tools to uphold white supremacy. And
they
Yeah, right. I mean, and I think that's just such an important point that you're making there, because the nostalgia is dangerous in that way. So I guess, like, talk a little bit more about your platform. Medicare for All, you support. Green New Deal, that you support. You also talk on your website about supporting reproductive rights. This is an unprecedented assault on abortion rights in this country. And the Republican Party and conservative groups see this as a massive opportunity. What would you do in Congress in order to help protect a woman's right to choose, woman's right to her own body? And honestly, what are you seeing as a member of the Pennsylvania State Legislature in terms of the initiatives on the ground?
Yeah. You know, reproductive health, I think, like a lot of other topics that, you know, are in my platform and progressive platforms, right, that we have been fighting for on the left, I think that one of the biggest barriers to winning on them is that lack of intersectionality, right? It's that lack of solidarity with who we're centering and who we're fighting for. Reproductive health is a prime example of that. So even as we're fighting for reproductive health, it oftentimes feels like or is led by white women, right? And it doesn't often center the particular
white feminists, right? The bane of our existence. Yes.
To it, right? That doesn't quite understand the unique kind of needs that Black women and femmes and mothering and birthing people would have, right? That trans folks might have in this process. The Black maternal mortality rate is absurd in my city, right? And in our country as a whole. But as we talk about reproductive health, we don't have enough people talking about the fact that we would make a woman give birth, but we can't guarantee that we can keep a Black woman alive in the process. And there's just not enough advocacy around that. There's not enough connecting those dots in this issue. And I think that my focus is always on how do we expand that, bring that perspective, right? How do we make sure that everybody is coming to this from every single angle that we should, so that we're not leaving out folks who would otherwise be fighting with us, right? And who we should otherwise be fighting for. And that's what I've done at the state level. That's what we've had to do at the state level, because there aren't trans folks in office or more queer folks. There aren't disabled folks. There aren't Black women in office.
Yeah, and that is why it's not just representation it's not just representation, it is just building power. That's why that is so important. And I appreciate your emphasis there. So, Summer, tell us a little bit more about your race, when it is, how people can help, how people can get involved in supporting you and your campaign.
Thank you for asking.
I sure.
I'm running here in Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania, and I believe that this race is one of the biggest opportunities we have on the left in the country, right? After Texas, where we got big victories and we are about to get, I hope, another big one. But I believe that this is the next big opportunity that we have. Empty seat. So it's an open seat for the first time in 26 years, right? We have a movement that we've already built around Pittsburgh, right? When I got in 2018, we've just been building ever since that. We've never stopped. So we've been expanding the electorate, expanding that base, bringing people in who had never seen folks like them or heard folks like them running for office and knocking on their doors. So I believe we've been building a huge coalition. Election day is on May 17th. We finally have an actual date in mass. Nice. It took very long to get those, right? So we have them. It's May 17th. We will have early voting again, right? Even though the Republicans, you ask what they do, they went to the courts to get their own law repealed so that we couldn't vote by mail. But the Supreme Court has halted that. We can do that, right? So our college students, our seniors, our disabled folks will be able to vote early. So we have a huge opportunity here. And we have been building a coalition that includes not just Bernie Sanders or right, Ayanna Pressley or JD or Sunrise. We have environmental organizations, all the progressive organizations. We have local electeds, city and county electeds, and statewide electeds. We have enough folks to reach the field, but we just got to grow. So we're going to knock doors. We need y'all to follow us. Follow me on Summer for PA on Twitter, Summer for PA on our website, Summer Leaf of Congress on Instagram. That's how you can keep track of everything that we're doing. You can plug in. We will keep you up to date. You can call from us. If you're not in Pittsburgh, you can call and you can send text with us. We will definitely plug you in. You can donate. I don't know if you're allowed to do that, but, you know, financial filing period is coming.
Okay, gotcha. Well, I mean, any way people can help, Summer for PA, go to Summer Lee's website and chip in if you can, help volunteer, door knock, etc. Summer, final question, is the black and yellow on purpose?
You know, this is the Steel City. It is our favorite color. So, you know, it's cute. It's a good color palette. Like, doesn't the yellow it's on the black?
No, I mean, I appreciate that it's the one of the few cities I can think of where it's like three major sports teams. They're all color coordinated. And that is, you know, I wish we had a little bit more of that here in New York. But I really appreciate it, Summer. Thanks so much for your time today. And go check out Summer PA, Summer for PA and support her campaign. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, folks, with that said, we are going to head into the fun half. But first, we have Binder and
Brandon. Yeah, they'll probably need to filter in at this moment now. If they
yes. Well, what happened on Left Reckoning last night, Matt?
So last night we had Nick Boland on to talk about why Democrats are losing rural America. We also had some good contributions from Kowalski on that in the postgame. But a very rural tinged night last night, because I saw Jacobin also did a very similar slate of shows with, I think, different guests. But I also talked about how Sturgis, when in the early 90s, they were having trouble with the rally, the motorcycle rally in Sturgis, being too pornographic and drunk, that they decided that the solution for that was to privatize it. Because they were high on that Reagan, or drunk off that Reagan Kool-Aid. And so they created Sturgis Rallies and Races Incorporated, and gave them control of the rallies. And what they did was sell a whole bunch of more liquor licenses and, start things like wet t-shirt contests, to the point where we have the Sturgis Rally during COVID where.
Wait, they thought it was too pornographic, so they started a wet t-shirt contest?
Well, look, you give it into a corporation and it turns out that they don't actually just want to do like the nice social sort of initiatives that a community wants. Mm. They instead want to maximize profit. Go figure.
Wow.
And that's what they did. And fast forward to the COVID-19, where a bunch of Sturgis residents didn't want the rally to happen because of there being a giant pandemic around that's killing up to 1 million Americans now. And it turned out that Sturgis Rallies and Races Incorporated and Governor Kristi Noem said, actually, that decision isn't yours. You privatized that. And so we're going to do the rally anyway. So we talked about that in the post game. So very rural show last night, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to that.
And speaking of rural as a topic, check out Nick Hanauer's piece in The Prospect. Yeah, is that how you say it?
I think so, yeah.
Democrats need to fix rural economies and get credit for it because...
I mean, that's sort of what we touched on. Is, yeah. And the solution isn't like... It's so over-mystified by, frankly, capitalists. Because look at a place like Wisconsin, for instance, you have a few different sectors of the economy. You have rural ag. You also have urban environments, and you have a sort of recreational seasonal employment. All of those groups would benefit from something like single-payer health care. And instead, we did this Obamacare stuff that everybody hates.
Yeah.
It delivers material, support for people, but not the political winner that, say, single payer would be.
No, for sure not. But with that said, we have Binder, and soon... All right. We'll see
how... kind of see our...
There we go.
Ooh, what's with the new camera setup?
Because I'm doing that thing where I take my shoes off when Sam's not in the office. Although I did it the... I like sitting cross-legged. That's the thing about me. I not using the non-PC term, but I like sitting like right.
Yeah, I think chairs are overrated. I mean, I was watching some
hard
anime,
to do that with your shoes.
And like, I maybe this is stereotypical, but I feel like the thing of Japan, where you sort of are cross-legged on the floor for meals and stuff like that.
Oh, it's great.
Seems awesome.
Yeah, it's probably good for your back too. But anyway, what's up, Binder? How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I can't believe the audience is look at it, it's Bradley, and they're seeing how the office is so messy. But anyway, what's
is
up, Binder?
New?
How are you?
Is this camera new? Do you guys just set this up?
Yes, it's new. Yeah.
Ooh, I like how you can see some sort of very large. What is that at the top of the screen there? It's some sort of pole.
It's the rig for the cameras that is no longer in use, but still up there.
Looks good. It looks very, very real. Let's put it that way. Very real.
Yes.
It's exactly, different furniture, but exactly the office I remember.
How you doing? What's happening over on Doomed and Scam Economy?
I'm doing good, and thank you for remembering the name of the show. on Doomed on Tuesday, I talked with Stephen Monticelli of Protein Magazine and Protein Magazine. I have one of those things where I see a word, I never hear it said, and then I just make up my own pronunciation.
Nice.
But he basically he did something that Sam Cedar could not. He debated Steven Crowder for real. He showed up at a college campus where Steven Crowder was, and he got in front of Steven Crowder for like 15 minutes to discuss Steven Crowder's most pressing topic of the day, which is obviously trans women playing in women's sports. And
Steven Crowder, famous
Christ.
Sports fan.
Right.
Who knows
yes.
a lot about sports.
Especially,
yeah, what'd you play, 5 years?
Especially women's on the college level swimming. He's a big fan of that. Long time.
That would have been a
very
good
pressing
question
issue.
Question is: can you name like several women swimmers, please?
Right, right. So he came on. Stephen came on the show to talk to me about that, and he actually had written previously about these two right wing twins who are behind this like anti-trans hate campaign going on in college campuses in Texas. And they're the ones who had invited Steven Crowder. So we got into his discussion, his debate with Crowder, his coverage of those two right-wingers who have been basically fomenting this hate in Texas. Very interesting episode. Check it out, doomthecast.com and at youtube.com/Matt Binder. And then tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern time, I will be talking with Amy Caster, who is basically an ape expert. And no, I don't mean monkeys and gorillas. I mean the Bored Ape Yacht Club. We will be diving deep into what this whole NFT project that has taken celebrities who are not disclosing the payments they've received for these things by storm.
Oh,
and that's at scameconomy.com.
Scam,
of course, youtube.com/MattBinder.
We lost Brandon.
I could keep promoting. I could keep going.
He's back. There he is. Hey, Brandon. We can't hear you.
I was saying you couldn't hear me, but I am back. Thank you. I couldn't get
there
myself.
There you are.
I couldn't get myself centered.
What's happening over on the discourse? And then we will head into the fun half real quick.
Oh, well, we should have an episode for everybody after the live show this weekend. So, you know.
Oh, yeah, I know. This will be my first time meeting Binder in person. Isn't that weird?
That will be right. This Saturday.
You've met Brandon.
Really?
Wow.
I've met Brandon. I mean, Brandon came in here.
Oh, yeah, that's
the
right.
Studio. Yeah,
I'm a polite person. I come in, I bring a gift, you know.
Yes. That's right. You brought a lot of cookies, and I think that resulted in like a 10-pound weight
Christmas
gain for me.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was trying to think on the positive side, but.
Well, they were amazing. I gave them out at Christmas to some family members, and at first I tried to pass it off as my own, but then I had like a glass of wine and I revealed that they were yours.
When I meet you on Saturday, I think this is going to, that you're going to be like the person who I've had interaction with online for like the longest, who I didn't already know in real life to begin with.
It's weird. It's crazy. It's so bizarre, but it'll be great. Looking forward to seeing you guys. But let's head into the fun half, 646-257-3920. We'll be taking a few calls, I think. But we have a lot of clips to get to, so we're going to get to that. See you then. There.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
What is up, everyone?
Nomi Keen.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke his 7-8?
Yes.
Yes.
Is it me?
It is you.
Is it me? Hello, is
it
me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go start
life. Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes to satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you
know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.